We'll hear argument now on number 89624, Maislin Industries versus Primary Steel. Mr. Auchincloss.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue presented in this case asks whether a shipper who utilizes the services of a motor common carrier has a legal right to the benefit of an unfiled illegal rate, or must the shipper pay the carrier's lawful tariff rate. Quinn Freight Lines, one of the petitioners in this case, was a motor common carrier that conducted operations in interstate commerce pursuant to authority granted by the ICC and under tariffs on file with the ICC. The respondents are a shipper, Primary Steel, who utilized the services of Quinn, and the Interstate Commerce Commission. The facts in this case indicate that Primary and Quinn negotiated rates for the transportation of steel products from a point in Connecticut to destinations in 12 states. Notwithstanding the fact that Quinn did not file its rates with the Interstate Commerce Commission, transportation was performed over a period of nearly 3 years, and roughly 1,100 shipments were transported. Following the bankruptcy of Maislin and Quinn, it was discovered by the rate auditors, who were retained by the estate of Maislin, that the transportation charges assessed Primary by Quinn were in fact not on file in tariffs on file with the ICC. The rate auditors made demand for payment of undercharges, that is the difference between the filed tariff rates and the unfiled rates that were assessed on the carrier's freight bills. Primary refused to pay the undercharges, and an action was instituted in the United States District Court in the District of Missouri, Kansas City specifically. The District Court, upon motion of Primary, referred three issues to the Interstate Commerce Commission for consideration. First, whether Quinn's rates, applicable filed tariff rates, that is, were in fact applicable to the shipments transported by Primary or by Quinn on behalf of Primary. Second, whether Quinn's rates were reasonable pursuant to standards established under the Interstate Commerce Act. And third, whether Quinn would be barred from the collection of its undercharges by virtue of two provisions contained in the Interstate Commerce Act. First, Section 10701, which relates to carrier practices, reasonable rates, and so on. And secondly, the so-called Tariff Requirement Act, or provision of the Act, which is Section 10761 of the Act. In an advisory decision issued by the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Commission ignored the applicability issue and the rate reasonableness issue, and instead decided that the carrier should be foreclosed from collecting its undercharges based solely on the language of Section 10701 of the Act, which again is that provision which requires carriers' rates and practices to be reasonable. Following the advisory decision, the District Court issued its decision in which it upheld the ICC advisory opinion, noting also that the negotiated rate proposition was an unreasonable practice and, in fact, foreclosed the carrier from collecting its undercharges. The Court also held that there was no provision contained in the Interstate Commerce Act which foreclosed the Commission from issuing a policy statement which, in effect, said that it would henceforth consider equitable defenses to carriers' efforts to collect lawful tariff charges. On appeal, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the District Court's decision for essentially the same reasons. Now, the conduct which gives rise to this case, an agreement between a common carrier and a shipper to do business at a rate other than the lawful filed tariff rate, is explicitly prohibited by the Interstate Commerce Act. In upholding the District Court's decision, the Court of Appeals failed to recognize the extremely narrow relief offered to shippers under the Interstate Commerce Act for the recovery of reparations or undercharges on past motor common carrier shipments. Congress has created a mechanism, a statutory framework, in fact, under which shippers and motor carriers will conduct their business. The essence of that framework is the common carrier's tariff. All transactions between shippers and motor carriers must be conducted pursuant to explicit tariff provisions. Section 10761 of the Act, Your Honor. Carriers cannot perform a service. They cannot perform transportation unless there are explicit provisions in the tariff which underlie that service or that transportation. All dealings conducted pursuant to the tariff, of course, are subject to scrutiny, either by the ICC or by other shippers or carriers who would have an interest in what the common carrier's holding out may be. Failure to adhere to the filed tariff can result in civil penalties or criminal penalties. That's why we say in our reply brief in this instance that, in fact, the unfiled illegal rate is the antithesis of the statutory rate policy promulgated by the Congress.
Mr. Auchincloss.
Suppose the railroad or the trucker had filed the rates like he said he would.
Yes, sir.
It would have applied to everybody, wouldn't it?
That's correct.
Not just this one transaction.
That's correct. Those rates are available for anybody who would utilize the services of a common carrier. That's precisely what the Act intends. The Act intends equality of treatment between shippers, and it's intended to avoid discrimination by permitting carriers and shippers to engage in these secret rate agreements, which foreclose from public view examination of the rate arrangements under which a shipper's transportation is performed.
Mr. Auchincloss, it used to be true, did it not, that even if the rate was unreasonably high when it was paid, the shipper could not get any money back if he paid the filed rate?
That's correct.
But that is no longer true.
That's
and that
correct.
Was true at the time we decided the time case.
That's correct. Well, prior to time, and time held, that shippers had no recourse for transportation rates that were applicable to past transportation.
But they now do.
But they now do in 1965.
So it really isn't true that anymore, at least, that the filed rate is the governing rate. What the most you can say is that it's the governing rate in one direction.
Well, it's the governing rate until the Interstate Commerce Commission, upon referral from a district court, in the instance of a motor carrier, a motor common carrier, determines that the carrier's rate was either not applicable or was unreasonable. There are explicit provisions in the Act now, which are the result of the 1965 legislation, which provide a mechanism by which shippers can ask the Commission whether or not a carrier's rates applicable to its past shipments were reasonable or not.
But in light of that change in the Act, might it not be reasonable to reconsider whether our decision in the time case should come out the same way?
Well, the provisions in the Act, which Congress formulated, provide shippers with a very narrow remedy for the relief that you suggest. As for relief in a prospective fashion or whether or not it's an attack upon an existing rate, I mean, there are other provisions in the Act which provide specifically how that mechanism should operate to give shippers relief. There are provisions that relate specifically to investigation and suspension proceedings, complaint proceedings, and in this instance, upon referral from a district court, whether or not a carrier's rates are reasonable or unreasonable.
But if they're held to be unreasonable on such a referral, everybody who's been charged that rate has some remedy. Is that it?
Everybody who has been charged that rate would certainly have a cause of action. That's correct. There is a rule of rate making contained in Section 10701C, I believe it is, of the Act, which provides specific standards by which the Commission must evaluate the reasonableness of carriers' rates, whether prospective for future application or whether in the instance of past transportation performed on behalf of a shipper, precisely what rates or what levels of rates are reasonable for that transportation.
Suppose we hold, as you wish in this case, that the shipper has to pay the tariff rate, even though it's unreasonable. So the shipper goes ahead and pays it. Can the shipper then bring a suit for reparations for the excessively high rate that he's been paying?
Well, I don't know whether you're talking in a hypothetical sense, Your Honor.
Well,
whether
no, I'm not talking hypothetical, because if that's the result of what we do today, that you just require two suits initially. Since the carrier cannot raise the issue, the shipper has to pay the money. But then, of course, the shipper can raise the issue, so he can...
Well, in that connection, I should say that in the Interstate Commerce Commission proceeding, evidence was submitted on referral from the district court addressing the reasonableness of the carrier's rates. In fact, extensive cost evidence was submitted which established, according to the expert retained by the Quinn estate, that the rates were within a so-called zone of reasonableness. Given that, those rates are, in fact, just and reasonable under the standards of the Act, an operating ratio based on a revenue cost basis was produced, which indicated that the composite revenue expense experience for that transportation produced an operating ratio of 96.3%. So in this particular case, the shipper has had that determination.
So you would not necessarily say that we would come out the way you want us to come out if this were a case in which it was an unreasonable rate? You would not be making the same arguments you're making?
That's correct. That's correct. Well, again, that opportunity was before the Commission. I mean, the Commission had ample opportunity, and the shipper had two occasions to object to the Commission's failure to reach a determination on rate reasonableness. First, it could have taken exception to the Commission decision, which in fact didn't address the matter of rate reasonableness. It let that opportunity pass. When the district court took the advisory decision and in effect made it its own, it took no exception at the district court level to that same absence of rate determination. So in fact, as I've already indicated, there were three issues presented to the district court.
So do we take this case on the assumption that the rate was reasonable, but that the decision just rests on whether it was an unreasonable billing practice?
That's precisely the case.
That's how we take
that's
the case.
That's exactly it. And in fact, a reference to the record in the case indicates quite clearly there is testimony presented by a cost expert, and of course the shipper presented his own cost expert, who developed evidence trying to show that the carrier's rate was not reasonable.
That had the challenge been to the reasonableness of the rate and had that been sustained, then that's a valid defense.
Well, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, if the Commission had made a determination that the carrier's rate was not reasonable, there would be no cause of action. In fact, the Commission has primary jurisdiction to consider the issue of rate reasonableness. And we concede that. There's absolutely no question about that.
What was the basis of the Commission's determination that this was an unreasonable practice?
Well, the Commission has taken Section 10701A of the Act, which requires that carrier rates, classifications, rules, and practices be reasonable. It has tied that together with its alleged primary jurisdiction, and the District Court bought this and the Court of Appeals bought it. And on the basis of that, simply say that we can negate the application of a filed rate by virtue of our rate reasonableness and practice reasonableness jurisdiction, and in effect not hold the carrier to the collection of his legal charges.
Well, what was the reasoning of the ICC?
Well, the reasoning is essentially that it has jurisdiction under 10701 to determine whether carrier practices are reasonable.
Yeah, but they based it on the fact that there was an agreement.
Yeah.
Well, there was an agreement, but it was
all
never
right,
reduced
to
tariff.
There was an agreement, and the shipper paid the lower rate relying on it, and the carrier failed to file a new tariff.
Well, that's correct.
And they say that's an unreasonable practice then. That's what they say.
That's what they say, but
What's wrong with that?
Well, this Court has held on at least two occasions, certainly in Time and Montana, Dakota, that rate reasonableness or practice reasonableness is not a justiciable legal right. It's simply a criterion for application in an administrative proceeding to determine a lawful rate.
Well, that frankly sounds like jargon to me.
Well, that's the Court's reasoning, Your Honor.
Well, maybe perhaps if the Court has been known to reason in jargon. But can you explain it in any more comprehensible language?
Try hard, Mr. Auchincloss. You're not really trying.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, you have to look at the framework, again, of the Interstate Commerce Act. 10761 is intended to keep the dealings of carriers and shippers open to the public. The Commission says the carrier engaged in an unreasonable practice by failing to bill its tariff rate, and therefore the shipper is entitled to this relief. We contend that the Congress has made no such provision. Maxwell, of course, and the cases that have come down since Maxwell are quite clear on the point that the shipper, his legal right is measured by the applicable lawful tariff. Now, he has a mechanism under the Interstate Commerce Act, and particularly in this instance, if it was past transportation charges, to allege in a carrier suit for undercharges that the carrier's rate was unreasonable. And when confronted with that, the district court has to refer that issue to the ICC. And if a rate reasonableness determination is reached, then, of course, the matter is resolved. And again, as Justice O'Connor...
The ICC used 10701 for this. It says a rate must be reasonable.
Well, again, that is not an explicit command to do anything other than look at the overall practices conducted by carriers in terms of their tariffs. I say, this is certainly recited in our reply brief, all of the practices of carriers must in one way or another be attached to its tariff. It is a fact that a carrier cannot engage in a practice that does not have some relation to its tariff. This is an agreement outside of the tariff. It has nothing at all to do with whether or not...
But why can't the ICC take a new look at the thing?
Well, it has in this instance, obviously.
Yeah, but why can't it?
Well, again, we say this is not what Congress intended. 10761 requires strict adherence to the file tariff. It is the mechanism by which all of this business is transacted. And looking at a billing practice, I mean, I suppose there are many practices carriers might engage in that conceivably have some bearing on its general holding out, but not something so central as whether or not a general provision like rate reasonableness can negate the application of a very specific requirement that tariffs maintain rates which are available for the public generally.
May I ask you a question about the facts of the case? This is the cargo that was carried here was steel.
That's correct.
This particular carrier carry steel for other shippers?
That's correct.
And at what rate were the other shippers charged?
Well, presumably, and it's really not in the record.
Well, if it's not in the record, then you really can't answer.
Well, the holding out of the carrier was its file tariff on file with the Interstate Commerce.
Was it holding out other than the fact that it had a file tariff?
No, it did not.
So that we really don't know what rate they charged others.
Well, I would say this, that there is evidence presented in the commission proceeding that dealt with the carrier's billing practices generally. And there were allegations made in the commission proceeding that the carrier was engaged in some kind of nefarious conduct which sought to avoid application of the filed rate requirement. However, that evidence indicated that the carrier's billing accuracy was over 99%. And in fact, most of the transactions, presumably on the basis of that, and at the time of its bankruptcy, the carrier was doing business with something like 23,000 shippers.
Yes, so, but they didn't all ship steel.
No, absolutely not. And
there were others that shipped steel.
Yes, I'm sure there were.
You're sure there were? Does the record tell us?
Well, the carrier had rates.
Because if there weren't, there wouldn't be really the danger of discrimination that lies at the heart of the filed rate doctrine.
Well, of course, there is not specific evidence in the record to answer your specific question.
So there is no evidence to show that the departure from the filed rate was discriminatory.
Not specifically as it relates to other specific shippers. That's correct. I should say also that the matter of the filed rate contained and the requirement contained in 10761 of the Act has some very specific exceptions which Congress has also put into the Interstate Commerce Act. Those relate specifically to the conduct of carriers pursuant to tariffs or at arrangements other than tariffs. And the most important of these is the requirement that, authority extended to the Commission to authorize contract carriers to conduct business at schedules that are not on file with the Interstate Commerce Commission. There are two explicit provisions in Section 10761 and 10762 which relate to the matter of relieving contract carriers from that requirement. So that specific exemption, we believe, stands in stark contrast to what the Commission is authorizing by virtue of its alleged authority under Section 10701 of the Act. There are other provisions which relate specifically to transportation by household goods carriers who are authorized to perform their transportation at binding estimates which need not relate to the tariff. They are simply concocted by whatever method the carrier might devise in order to arrive at its reasonable charges.
In this case, is there evidence that the parties purported to be negotiating a new tariff, or was it just an agreement to discount off the existing tariff?
Well, there were communications between the carrier and the shipper in which they agreed that the transportation charge would be whatever it was. That was reduced to some handwritten letter form, which passed between the two and simply recited what the rates would be by destinations from the Connecticut origin.
Suppose it were clear from the course of dealing that the parties purported to be agreeing on a new tariff that the carrier would then file, and then the carrier just neglects to file.
Well, that situation could arise, quite obviously, and it didn't in this situation, but in instances in which the carrier alleges he's going to file his tariff and he doesn't, and it's later discovered that this situation has developed, the carrier or the shipper has recourse, again, pursuant to the provisions in the Act which permit determinations of whether or not that carrier's rate is reasonable or not.
Didn't this carrier promise to file the tariff that he negotiated with the shipper?
No, there was no explicit promise to do anything. In fact, there's testimony from two of the officials of the shipper who simply indicate they had no knowledge of tariffs.
There was no finding in any either the agency or the lower courts on this point?
Not directly, no. I mean,
when you say not directly, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that they engaged in this transaction and discussion to arrive at rates, but the carrier never said, and it was never reduced to any written form or other form, that I will file that in a tariff I have on file with the Interstate Commerce Commission. And the shipper, again, alleged that he had no knowledge of tariffs. So the question apparently didn't arise in their dealings as to exactly how this conduct would proceed.
But I take it from the answer you gave to me, it wouldn't make any difference in your view of the case in any event.
That's correct. The filed rate is required to be applied, and it's available to all shippers who would utilize the service of that carrier. And, of course, it should have been in this instance. And the only relief available to the shipper is a determination that the filed rate, in fact, was not just and reasonable.
Mr. Auchincloss, what was the unreasonable practice found by the Commission specifically? Was it the charging of rates below the tariff rate, or was it the quoting of rates below the tariff rate and then the attempt to collect the tariff rate?
Well, the Court of Appeals terms it a billing practice. The carrier's practice of billing rates that were not contained in its tariff was an unreasonable practice.
The unreasonableness is not trying to get the full tariff rate, even though you agreed to less. The unreasonableness was agreeing to less in the first place.
That's correct. That's correct. Right. Well, essentially, again, it comes in the form of they latch on to this word practice contained in 10701 of the Act.
Commission call it?
The Commission calls it a billing practice, the carrier's billing and collection practices.
Well, but I would think they what the issue is whether they could collect the tariff.
That's correct.
I mean, collect what they should have.
Well, collect what they should have under the filed tariff.
To try to collect what they hadn't agreed to. What is the unreasonable practice? Trying to collect something they had agreed not to, or what?
Well, the Commission says the Commission says that the billing practice, which the carrier engaged in, which resulted in the non-application of the filed rate, resulted in the carrier charging something less, and the carrier should be foreclosed from collecting its undercharges. That is the difference between the lower quoted rate and the higher filed rate.
Well, what does the Commission suggest would keep whatever suggest to the carrier that it adhere to its tariffs?
Well, the Commission makes no suggestion along those lines at all. In fact, the Commission has been opposed to the current Commission, at least, has been opposed to the filed tariff system in its entirety. They have made statements on the Hill that they think this is a process that doesn't serve the pro-competitive aspects of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. In fact, however, we say, as this Court said in Square D, if that's a matter that must be reviewed, then it should be reviewed by Congress. Congress, in enacting the 1980 legislation, made it clear that the explicit instructions were being, in effect, issued to the Commission to follow a certain course of conduct. One of those very explicit requirements was if you do business with a motor common carrier, or for that matter, a railroad.
So it doesn't make any difference it doesn't make any difference to the Commission whether the carrier had ever intended to live up to its tariff or not. All it had to do was to quote a lower rate and That's the end of it.
That is one of the evils of this case. That's correctly. That's precisely the point. What would stop shippers in the future from engaging in precisely that kind of conduct with carriers who are willing to do it? You can do your business as a common carrier on the strength of a telephone call quotation of a rate or a letter quotation of a rate, disregarding what's contained in the tariff and then subsequently alleging that, well, we had a negotiated rate, so it really doesn't matter what my tariff provided.
I take it that in the Commission's view, departing from the tariff would could never result in any kind of a penalty of any kind?
Well, the Commission says that it is not overturning or modifying to any significant degree the carrier's requirement, the common carrier's requirement, that he file tariffs with the Commission, and he observes those. But, of course, that's a statement in the breach. It's not a statement in the application because, in fact, we have here.
Did you say that departing from the filed rate could be a crime?
Yes, it is. It's a penalty.
And a civil penalty?
It could be civil if there's intentional misapplication.
Well, I guess saying it's an unreasonable practice wouldn't prevent the imposition of a penalty from departing from the tariff.
Well, the Commission has powers to determine what practices generally may result in violations of explicit provisions of the Act, but they must be explicit provisions. Civil penalties and criminal penalties attached to failure of a carrier to apply its filed tariff, and if there's a rebate situation involved, that's a criminal proposition.
I suppose the Commission could say, well, you've been unreasonable, and you not only can't collect this this difference between the tariff and what you charge, but we're also going to penalize you for departing from the tariff.
The Commission could if it would, mm-hmm. Yes.
But you don't think that's much of incentive to
Well, the Commission has not been enforcing those provisions in the Interstate Commerce Act, Your Honor. The Commission could have stopped this whole process early on after the enactment of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. If the Commission had simply made examples of those carriers and shippers who were engaged in this kind of conduct, it could have cited them, brought them to court, and corrected the problem, but it never occurred. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Auchincloss. Mr. Merrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The facts and legal issues presented by this case are typical of hundreds of proceedings which are now pending in the lower courts involving insolvent motor carriers. These cases share a common pattern or sequence of events which consists of the following. First, a shipper negotiates a rate with a motor carrier, an event which happens hundreds and even thousands of times today, every day, under the competitive regime established by the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. Second, the carrier fails to file that rate in a tariff, as it's required to do by the Interstate Commerce Act. Third, as the shipper relies on the carrier to do.
Mr. Mill, Mr. Auchincloss said there was no evidence in this case that there was ever any agreement on the part of the shipper and the carrier that the carrier would file the new rate.
There was no evidence of an agreement, but the Commission specifically found that Primary, the shipper, relied on Quinn, the carrier, to implement properly the quoted rates. That's at page 43A of the petition.
So the Commission found that the shipper relied on the carrier.
The Commission's finding was that the shipper relied on the carrier to do everything that the law requires to properly implement the negotiated rate, yes.
Doesn't every shipper do that? I mean, is that a special finding for this case? I assume every shipper assumes that the carrier is going to comply with the law.
It probably is true that most every shipper assumes that the carrier will comply with the law. I think people doing business assume that.
If that alone were a justification for departing from the tariff, from the filed rate, it'd always be a justification for a departure.
What I think the important point here about the Commission's reliance element is that there can be no evidence that the shipper had knowledge that the carrier, in fact, was not intending to file the rate in the tariff. That type of evidence would suggest that the shipper, as well as the carrier, was in violation of the law, and particularly it violated the Elkins Act. But there's no requirement in the statute that imposes a duty on the shipper to make inquiry of the carrier about whether it's complying with the law. And so the Commission has carefully tailored its negotiated rates policy to conform with the various statutory requirements, and that's the main purpose of the element that the shipper must have been able to reasonably rely on the carrier doing whatever the law requires to lawfully implement its rate.
Mr. Merrill, do we take this case on the assumption that the tariff rate was a reasonable rate?
Justice O'Connor, the Commission did not reach the rate reasonableness issue. It said
in our addressing the legal issue, do we need to assume that it was a reasonable rate?
I don't think the legal analysis should turn on whether the rate was either assumed to be reasonable or assumed to be unreasonable. The Commission
Well, in answering my question, then, I want you to assume it was a reasonable rate.
Yes.
And then tell me whether the statute, 10761A, requires the carrier to collect the file tariff.
The statute does require that, Justice O'Connor.
And are there criminal penalties and civil penalties potentially for not doing that?
Yes, there are. The carrier is subject to potential criminal liability for knowingly charging a rate less than the tariff rate or soliciting a rate less than the tariff
rate.
Well,
then how can the Commission say under those circumstances that not collecting the tariff is an unreasonable billing practice?
I think what the Commission has done here
It seems very hard to understand.
The Commission is not forgiving carriers of their obligation to file rates and tariffs. The Commission has no intention of doing that whatsoever, and it's stated that quite explicitly in both of its negotiated rates opinions. What the Commission is doing here is finding that the carrier has committed an unreasonable practice by, among other things, violating its statutory duties. Petitioners have suggested or tried to obscure the fact of who's really at fault here, suggesting that somehow the shipper is somehow to blame for this. But it's under the statute, it's the carrier that has the duty to file its agreed-upon rates and tariffs. It's the carrier that has the duty to charge and collect the tariff rate, which it did not do for years here. It was billing the shipper at the negotiated rate, not at the tariff rate. And so it's the carrier that's committed statutory violations. And what the Commission has said is that in terms of administratively determining the appropriate remedies for violations of those sections of the Act and for committing unreasonable practices.
We are going to compel you to continue to violate it.
No, we are going,
is what they've said in effect.
We are going to declare it an unreasonable practice for the carrier to obtain a windfall, essentially, based on its own violation of the statute.
But in answering Justice O'Connor, you spoke as though the only obligation of the carrier is to file the tariff rate.
No,
it is not. It is his obligation to charge the tariff rate.
It's stated in the first sentence of 706.1a says the carrier must file, and 706.2a says the same thing. And then the second section of section 706.1a says the carrier must only charge and collect.
Must charge and collect that. And what the Commission has said, as Justice O'Connor pointed out, is that complying with that is an unreasonable billing practice.
No, the Commission has not said that simply not collecting the tariff rate is an unreasonable billing practice. What the Commission has said is that when these four elements are identified, negotiation of the rate, reliance by the shipper on the carrier's compliance with all statutory requirements, nevertheless, the carrier goes ahead and charges and collects the negotiated rate, not the tariff rate, over a long period of time, typically. And finally, many years later, typically when the carrier is bankrupt, comes back and attempts to collect a much higher tariff rate, that course of conduct taken together is an unreasonable practice. And when the facts are found by the Commission that will support a finding that there is an unreasonable practice, the Commission will advise the courts that the unreasonable practice should preclude the carrier from collecting its full tariff charges.
And the undercharging may have put it into bankruptcy.
It's possible that the carrier, through its own improvidence, went into bankruptcy. There may be no action.
I think creditors have some stake in this, don't they?
Yes, but I don't think there's any conflict between the bankruptcy laws and the Commission's negotiated rates policy. The Commission's the policy doesn't apply just to bankruptcy.
Well, I would suppose if the carrier had an obligation to collect a rate that it didn't collect, somebody owes it something.
That's correct, but
and
the carrier
the creditors
has no right
ought to insist the trustee bring a lawsuit, which he did.
The carrier has no right to collect a tariff rate that's found to be unreasonable. The petitioners this afternoon have conceded that if the Commission enters a finding that the rate was unreasonable, the Commission's finding of unreasonableness.
No, but we judge this case as though the rate was reasonable.
And similarly, the Commission has found in negotiated rates that if the carrier has committed an unreasonable practice, which is defined by these elements that I've summarized, that the finding of an unreasonable practice should supersede the filed tariff rate and prevent full collection. So, essentially, the carrier or its trustee in bankruptcy is asserting the right to collect an unreasonable charge, and there's no right that creditors of the bankrupt have to obtain the benefit of an illegal charge. Again, let me stress that the statutory violations which admittedly have occurred here are duties which the statute imposes on the carrier. They are not imposed on the shipper. The carrier is essentially before this court seeking to obtain a windfall produced by its own statutory violations. The shipper has engaged in no affirmative misconduct in these cases whatsoever, and in fact typically has no way to get these charges back because they were passed on to the extent they were passed on to the shipper's customers years ago, and those transactions have long since been closed. The only real difficulty with the Commission's the only two legal issues, I think, that need to be resolved in order to uphold the Commission's policy are two. Petitioners have conceded that if this were an unreasonable rates case, that the Commission's order finding unreasonable rate would supersede the tariff rate. So one issue that has to be decided is whether or not there's any difference under the statute between unreasonable rates and unreasonable practices, whether the statute draws a line between those two things such that a finding of unreasonable practices does not supersede a tariff filing, whereas a finding of unreasonable rates would. And the second issue is whether or not the Commission has primary jurisdiction to consider unreasonable practice claims that are referred to it by the courts. And I think the answer to both of those questions is that the Commission's decision is fully justified. The provision that carriers must engage in reasonable practices is found in the very same sections of the statute that say that the carrier must charge reasonable rates. Section 10701A and Section 10704. So the same statutory provisions govern both cases. In addition, this Court has held on many occasions that when a claim of unreasonable practices is raised in the course of a judicial action, that claim implicates the administrative discretion of the ICC and must be referred to the ICC for determination. It can't be decided by court. So in terms of the primary jurisdiction jurisprudence, the Court has drawn no distinction between unreasonable rates and unreasonable practices. And for those reasons, we think that the petitioner's suggestion that somehow, merely because the Commission is relying on its practices jurisprudence here authority rather than its rates authority, that a different result ought to maintain. I think it's also important that what's involved here is the Commission's essentially attempting to reconcile two different provisions of the statute. We have Section 10761A, which is the petitioner's rely on, that requires the carrier to file its rates and tariffs and collect only the tariff rates, but you also have the duty to engage to maintain reasonable practices. The petitioner's theory essentially is that the one section, the tariff filing section, completely trumps the unreasonable rates practice because neither the courts nor the Commission would have any authority whatsoever to grant relief to shippers in this type of circumstance presented by this case. There would be no way that they could obtain any type of damages or reparations for unreasonable practices that are in fact statutory violations. But the Commission's determination here has essentially attempted to accommodate or reconcile these two statutory provisions.
Mr. Merrill, can I ask about this, what the unreasonable practice is again? As I understand it, it would not have been an unreasonable practice if they had been agreeing to the lower rate but charging the higher rate, the tariff rate, all along.
I think that's correct.
And it would not have been an unreasonable practice if they had been agreeing to the lower rate and charging the lower rate all along and then continued to charge the lower rate the last time around. That also would not have been an unreasonable practice.
You mean if no collection action was?
Right. You said it was essential to the whole thing that there had been the prior practice of both agreeing to and actually billing the lower rate.
I don't think the attempt to collect the rates adds anything to the unreasonableness. It simply is the occasion on which the Commission becomes aware that these unreasonable practices has been going
on. So the unreasonable practice then is not trying to collect the higher rate. It's just
agreeing to the lower rate, the shipper's reliance on the carrier to conform that rate to the law, i.e., file it in a tariff, and finally...
That's not a billing practice.
That's a solicitation practice. And finally, the carrier's persisting in charging and collecting the negotiated rate as opposed to the tariff rate. These are cases typically that have gone on for
some period of time. Part of the element of that, the failure to file is part of the unreasonable.
The failure to file is a key part, yes. I mean, the statute in two places, I've already mentioned them, 10761A and 10762, imposes on the carrier the duty to file the rates for its transportation services in tariffs, and the carrier has violated that duty in this case.
Well, but you could say that in any case where the carrier agrees to a lower rate, doesn't file a tariff for that lower rate, and then bills the lower rate, you could say there's been an unlawful billing practice. But I had thought that our case law prevents that. I had thought that, what the statute means is you have to bill the tariff rate.
Well, the Commission's not, again, I mean, the petitioners try to suggest that the Commission has repealed the filed tariff doctrine. The Commission has no intention of doing that whatsoever. And the Commission, for example, the Commission's policy doesn't apply to cases of isolated misquotation. The Commission's policy only applies to the circumstances identified in its decision.
From the tariff?
No, a misquotation would be where there's an agreement to abide by the tariff and some mistake occurs. That's like in the facts in the Maxwell case where Mr. Maxwell basically was of the same state of mind as the railroad. They both wanted him to be able to go wherever it was, St. Louis, to Salt Lake City and back at a certain rate, and the railroad just got the wrong line on the tariff.
I suppose the Commission's approach would cover the situation where the shipper wants a lower rate than he knows is in the carrier's tariff, and the tariff says, well, you're a great customer, you're going to get the lower rate, but please don't tell anybody. And he goes ahead and charges it for 2 or 3 years, and then he goes bankrupt.
No, the Commission's policy would not apply.
Why not?
Well, because the statute, Section 11902 of the Interstate Commerce Act, which is part of the Elkins Act, imposes treble damage liability on shippers for knowingly accepting a rebate from the tariff rate. So if the Commission, I think, was trying to navigate around that quite clearly. The Commission did not want to vindicate shippers who have engaged in what is a clear statutory violation. But that's the only point in the statute.
So the shipper has to be innocent. Is that it?
That's correct. The shipper may not have knowledge of the carrier's derelictions of its statutory duty. The negotiated rates policy only applies in those cases where the shipper is innocent, has not informed itself, and otherwise has no notice.
Was there a finding to that effect here?
Yes. I think the Commission again found that recall the precise language at this moment, but on page 42A and 43A of the Commission's decision in this case, there's discussion of the states of mind of both the carrier and the shipper. And it's clear also from the evidence that was submitted in the record that the shipper was not vigilant in this case. The shipper did not hire a tariff watching agency or something like that to double check on the carrier to make sure it was not breaching its statutory obligations. But there's no suggestion in the evidence that the shipper had actual knowledge or notice of the carrier's misdeeds.
Mr. Merrill, may I ask you a question about the Commission's policy? It's not directly involved in this case, but if there were negotiated rates, two different negotiated rates for competing types of shipments that should normally be covered by the filed tariff, but they were not the same, would the policy apply?
In other words, you have
discrimination between negotiated rates.
One tariff and one shipper negotiates, the other one doesn't?
No. The one carrier negotiates with two different shippers and tells them both that he will file the negotiated rate. But the two shippers get different negotiated rates.
I see. What you've just described is really an everyday happening in the motor carrier industry today. Negotiation of rates.
That triggers a concern that isn't necessarily shown by the record of this case, the possibility of discrimination, which has always been something that...
Yes, the Act still prohibits discrimination. There's no question about that, discrimination, however, is defined more narrowly today than it was back in the heyday of the filed rate doctrine and the court's early decisions. A shipper has to show competitive injury in order to establish a discrimination, and the carrier can defeat a claim of discrimination by showing that there's some relevant difference in the transportation characteristics of the two movements, like the costs are different, for example. But If those elements are satisfied, if a shipper can show competitive injury, that there's a disparity in rates, that the same carrier controlled both rates, and the carrier can't show a difference in costs or other relevant transportation characteristics, yes, discrimination is a possibility. But what's really going on in the motor carrier industry, and the Commission's decision reflects this, is that at least when you're dealing with something like we are in this case, which is a full truckload shipment of a particular commodity, steel in this case, which is carried on flatbed trucks, that it's common throughout the industry for carriers to call up shippers and to dicker over rates and for the parties to reach an agreement about a particular rate that will apply. And this is true for companies like Primary, and it's true for Primary's competitors.
Here to the file tariffs.
No. We don't think it's a common practice not to file.
Well, what did you just say?
It's a common practice to negotiate a rate with the expectation.
Yes, which isn't a tariff rate.
With the expectation that the negotiated rate will then be filed in the tariff. That's correct. Now, these are what are called commodity rates. You have to remember.
Well, it is common practice not to common practice to agree to charge a rate that is not on file with the Commission.
No, there's an agreement on a rate with the understanding that then, before the movement
occurs.
Well,
there was no such understanding in this case, and you say that it's irrelevant to this case.
There was no specific proof of an agreement to file a tariff.
Well, you say it's irrelevant to whether there was or not.
Well, the Commission's policy is that what is relevant is whether or not the shipper relied on the carrier to do what was necessary to comply with the law, which includes filing the tariff rate. But there was no
specific shippers
proof.
Do. I mean, all shippers do. Anybody I deal with, I assume that they're going to comply with the law. Can't you always say that unless there's some indication where they specifically agree? Now, I'm telling you I'm not going to file this rate, I suppose. But normally, if they say nothing about it, the Commission would say the same thing it did here, wouldn't it?
I agree with you, Justice Scalia, that people who do business normally assume that the people they're doing business with will comply with the law. They think that they're not conspiring to violate the antitrust laws, that they're paying their taxes, and so forth. And essentially, under the Commission's policy, unless there is some indication that the shipper is conniving with the carrier to discriminate against its competitors by getting some off-tariff rate, and that there's no expectation by either party that it's going to be filed, the policy will apply. But you'd have to say, if there's some showing of that, then the policy does not apply.
Mr. Middle, can I ask this? You said earlier that there are hundreds of cases involving this problem. Do you have any idea what percentage of those hundreds of cases involve rates that are reasonable rates, or as to which there is no claim that the rates, that the tariffed rates were unreasonable?
I have no idea, Justice Scalia. I think that
might make a big difference. I mean, we're not talking here about whether the Commission might achieve this by finding the rate to have been unreasonable.
The Commission has not entertained very many cases on the merits since 1980. Alleging unreasonable motor carrier rates. They have been quite scarce.
Like the concept.
What?
Yeah, they don't
doesn't
have
like
to.
The concept.
Well,
they don't have to. They
the
get
shippers don't like the concept either, because the shippers can go out and get different quotations and tariff rates from different carriers. I mean, competition in the marketplace has really eliminated a lot of the need for supervision of unreasonable rates and discriminatory rates, which is what Congress basically had in mind when it passed the 1980 Act. Let me specifically make mention of the court's case law, which is relied on here, and in particular the so-called filed rate doctrine, and point out, first of all, that the filed rate doctrine is not a term which appears in the statute, nor is it a term, as far as I'm aware, which appears in any of this court's cases construing the Interstate Commerce Act. That term can be found in some gas cases, but does not appear in the court's decisions under the Interstate Commerce Act, and I think it's important that the court act with some precision in defining exactly what is meant by that term in deciding this particular case. The older cases that are cited, Maxwell, Fink, Mugg, and so forth, are all cases that were adjudicated in court. There was no reference to the ICC. The ICC was not a party in those cases. And basically, the holdings of those cases are that a court is not permitted to deviate from the filed tariff rate and inquire whether the rate is reasonable or whether equitable circumstances might create a valid defense to collection of the tariff rate. At the same time that those cases make state that rather inflexible rule, the cases also recognize that the rule does not apply to the Interstate Commerce Commission. Maxwell itself says that the strict rule applies unless the Commission finds that the rate's unreasonable. And there are
The Commission has gotten after some carrier for negotiating a rate lower than the tariff rate and, in short, just plain violate the statute?
The Commission, I don't know the names of the cases, but I asked and I was told that the Commission has had enforcement proceedings within the recent 1988 and 89 against
because
carriers.
Because if you say this practice is just common everyday occurrence around, and the commission isn't doing anything about it. It sounds like the whole business of requiring carriers to comply with the statutory requirement of charging the same to everybody is just hash.
Well, I don't think it's that bad, Justice White. The commission wants to encourage carriers to file these rates and tariffs. I mean, the commission has nothing against
the
tariff filing requirement.
How are they doing that?
Well, first of all, this proceeding is largely retrospective in orientation. The commission was confronted with a problem. The problem was this avalanche of lawsuits filed in bankruptcy proceedings with carriers seeking to recover much, much higher rates than had been agreed to with shippers. And the commission basically, in these proceedings, these negotiated rates proceedings, is trying to figure out what's the best thing to do about that problem. And I think by telling the carrier that you can't gain a windfall, you can't somehow, after the fact, obtain a huge increase in the rate that the shipper never agreed to, in fact, helps to serve to dissuade carriers from engaging in this unreasonable practice. I don't think there's any tension or inconsistency between a deterrence-type rationale and what the commission is doing in this particular case. The commission has not gone by special proceeding beyond this to focus on whether or not some other measures might be appropriate to try and encourage carriers to toe the line. But at least insofar as what they've done here, I don't see any inconsistency between what they've done and those larger objectives. I hate to use that word because these old cases from this court say that no estoppel is permitted, but it's a commission finding of an unreasonable practice which supersedes filed rate requirement. Let me briefly mention the second legal issue. I said the first legal issue really was whether or not the a different rule should apply for unreasonable practices and unreasonable rates, and turn briefly to the primary jurisdiction issue since it's featured in the petitioner's briefs. And is an argument that can generate some confusion. And the question here is whether, although of course the Commission has primary jurisdiction to consider an unreasonable rate referral from a court, it has no primary jurisdiction to consider an unreasonable practices referral. And we don't think that there's any basis for this either in the time decision or anywhere else. Essentially, the argument is that the unreasonable practice involved here falls into a crack. In the law. The petitioners admit that if this were an unreasonable rate claim, it would be expressly governed by the statute that Congress passed to overrule the time decision. And they admit that if this were an unreasonable practice of the sort that was involved in the Hewitt-Robbins case, which was decided 3 years after time, it would also be subject to the Commission's primary jurisdiction. But they say that this case falls into a crack between those two broad areas of the law and therefore is not subject to primary jurisdiction. The key assumption that they're making is that the rationale of the time decision lives on even though time was overturned by Congress, and that under the rationale of the time decision there would be no basis to refer this issue to the Commission because the rationale of the time decision was that the Commission can't accept a case on referral where it doesn't have independent jurisdiction to grant relief on its own. And the short answer to that is that that particular rationale was expressly repudiated by this Court in the Hewitt-Robbins case, which was decided 3 years after time. At page 89 of Hewitt-Robbins, the Court said this, and I quote, "The practice of the Commission in making such determination in the first place, even though it has no power to award reparations in a given case, has long been exercised and is supported by a long line of cases." In short, this Court itself repudiated the rationale that the petitioners are relying upon shortly after the time case came down. And for that reason alone, Commissioner's argument has no merit and should be rejected. The Court has no further questions. I thank the Court.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Mr. Auchincloss, you have rebuttal. You have 2 minutes remaining.
I do, Your Honor. I think it's well to look at the Hewitt-Robbins case in light of the government's argument. In fact, Hewitt-Robbins involved a practice of routing. Carrier routed interstate shipments or intrastate shipments over an interstate route and thereby applied a higher rate than was applicable under its interstate or intrastate route. The result being, and this is what this Court held, that common law right to a reasonable route exists and was not extinguished by the enactment of the Interstate Commerce Act. That's the kind of practice the Commission has traditionally looked at, and that's the kind of practice the Court has looked at in terms of what is a lawful proposition versus an unlawful proposition. We contend here, of course, that in fact the secret rate agreement is an unlawful proposition. The Commission and the courts have always wrestled with practices that revolve around tariff provisions, not around secret agreements. The government says that the culprit in this is the carrier because the carrier failed to follow through on its duty to file a tariff. Well, in fact, the law charges shippers with knowledge of tariff provisions as well. And Primary was no small shipper. The record indicates it shipped 43 million pounds via this carrier over a nearly three-year period. So, in fact, the conduct that we're talking about was not unreasonable in terms of the carrier's practice solely. It was the shipper who neglected to even ask the carrier whether or not it had a tariff applicable to this movement, notwithstanding its allegations. It knew nothing about the law. The law requires this, but I know nothing about it. It made shipments to United States Steel, one of the largest producers in the country, obviously, and notwithstanding that United States Steel undoubtedly audits its freight bills, Primary says it didn't have to. So this whole process.
Thank you, Mr. Auchincloss. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.